Good morning, this is AM, I'm Michael Brissenden. More details are emerging about the latest turn back of asylum seekers to Indonesia. A document given to the ABC by Indonesian police provides new details about how Australian authorities allegedly intercepted an asylum seeker boat, transferred the passengers onto two boats and sent them back to Indonesia. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees says it's been told the group of 65 asylum seekers saw an Australian official hand a thick envelope to the captain of their vessel before the boat was turned around. Our Indonesia correspondent is George Roberts, and I spoke to him a short time ago. George Roberts, what have the Indonesian police shown you? What evidence have they shown you?
Well, the spokesman for Indonesian police here in West Timor has given us a document, an internal police document, which is a presentation of their initial findings from their investigation into the alleged turn back by Australian authorities and also into the allegations that Australian authorities paid more than $30,000 to the crew of the boat in order to return the asylum seekers back to Indonesia. And what this document does, and they've backed it up with some photographs of the wads of cash that were allegedly provided by the Australian authorities and the two boats that were allegedly provided by Australian authorities. And these documents map out the whole trip right back from the recruitment by people smugglers of the crew of the boats back in April, the pickup of the passengers off West Java, and then their journey to the waters off East Timor, where they were allegedly first intercepted by Australian authorities.
And what actually happened on the water? Because there are reports that the Australians actually intervened and told them that their boat was unseaworthy and then turned them back.
According to this document, they were intercepted twice. They were intercepted once by a customs ship, and they were given a warning that they were not allowed to enter Australian waters or enter Australia, actually, without appropriate visas. They were given or shown warning cards, which is a fairly standard procedure, where there are cards that are handed out to the passengers and crews of boats in the various languages that the people on board speak, that tell them that, you know, this is the Australian policy and that's not what they're allowed to do. They were apparently then allowed to go on their voyage, and they travelled for a number of days, about 4 days according to this police document, before being intercepted again by Australian authorities. And it was at that point when Australian authorities, according to this initial investigation by Indonesian police, told them that they were not able to continue, that their boat was not in sufficient condition, and that the conditions of the ocean would mean that they weren't able to make it to New Zealand. There was some kind of interrogation of the captain, according to this document, at that point in time, and some kind of deal struck. It's then alleged that they were taken to Australian waters and then taken to just off the coast of the Ashmore Islands, where they anchored for a couple of days. And then Australian authorities apparently provided two boats and split up the passengers and crew onto those two boats, and they were sent back towards Indonesia after this alleged exchange of money took place. The captain, Johannes Humiang, was allegedly paid $6,000, and the other five crew members were paid about $5,000 each in order to take the passengers back towards Indonesia.
Indonesia correspondent George Roberts there. The government has secured a budget saving of nearly $2.5 billion in a deal with the Greens. The Social Services Minister Scott Morrison and the Greens leader Richard Di Natale have agreed to a tighter assets test for the age pension. Senator Di Natale says he's convinced the government to put superannuation back on the agenda, but Labor says he's been dudded because the government has made it clear it will stand by its pledge to leave super unchanged. Political correspondent Louise Yaxley reports.
Around 170,000 pensioners with modest assets would get $30 a fortnight more under this deal. But at the top end, there are losers. The part pension would cut out for a couple with assets of $823,000 on top of their family home. Currently, it's $1.1 million. The Social Services Minister, Scott Morrison, says it will save $2.5 billion over 4 years.
The single largest saving measure in this budget.
Labor's Jenny Macklin says that saving comes from part pensioners losing thousands.
330,000 part pensioners will lose money.
Senator Di Natale says it's fairer.
It reverses the changes that the Howard government introduced back in 2007, which we opposed back then. I thought that Labor would support it, to be frank. I was surprised that Labor would be out there defending the Howard legacy, the 2007 largesse that was being, the wads of cash that were being handed out to people on high incomes.
Ms Macklin defends the current system.
The pension system in Australia is one of the most targeted in the world. What's not sustainable in Australia is the large amount of tax concessions for superannuation going to some of the wealthiest people.
Richard Di Natale says the government's agreed to put superannuation back on the agenda.
We also get a broader review into income retirements. We think that's really important. We get superannuation back on the table as part of the tax white paper.
Ms Macklin says the Greens have been naive.
Completely gutted. Tony Abbott has said day after day in the Parliament that he is not going to change the tax concessions on superannuation, and the Greens have sold pensioners out.
The head of ACOS, Cassandra Goldie, suggested the tighter assets test, so she welcomes the deal.
And we are particularly pleased that as part of this arrangement, there's a firm commitment from the government to now specifically look at the superannuation tax concession arrangement.
Mr Morrison reinforces the government doesn't want super to change.
But the government has made it crystal clear that our policy when it relates to superannuation and particularly taxation and the flexibility of people's arrangements is unchanged.
Michael O'Neill from Seniors Australia says he's concerned, especially for singles, whose part pension would cut out with assets of $500,000 on top of the family home rather than $800,000.
We have numerous examples of teachers, for example, who've worked their whole life, has now retired at age 65, has just over $500,000 in assets excluding the family home. She will be outside the proposed new taper rate. By the time you take off the value of a car, some household assets and whatever, she'll have under $500,000 to invest and will earn about $19,000, $20,000 per year from that. Now that's $3,000 or $4,000 less than the pension, so clearly she's going to be at a disadvantage.
Michael O'Neill from Seniors Australia, ending that report from Louise Yaxley. The nation's leaders are this morning taking part in an interfaith breakfast in Canberra against the backdrop of continuing concern within Australia's Muslim community about a backlash from events overseas. The Prime Minister and opposition leader are attending the inaugural prayer breakfast, which organisers hope will become an annual gathering for religious tolerance. But at a grassroots level, at least one Islamic community leader believes the government's strong rhetoric on jihadists is brewing intolerance towards Muslims. Bill Birtles reports.
As politicians and leaders from more than 30 different faith groups eat together at Old Parliament House this morning, they're being asked to ponder the state of religious tolerance in Australia. The head of the New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Board, Stepan Kirkisharian, is addressing the gathering. He says the Islamic State conflict overseas is testing attitudes towards multiculturalism here.
At this particular point in time when religion is being abused by people for geopolitical purposes in the most horrific way, a lot of responsibility rests on our leaders, religious leaders, political leaders, community leaders, to send a very strong message out to people, particularly to young people, to say that we respect differences.
Stepan Kirkisharian says the constant focus on the conflict in the Middle East is affecting community attitudes, and he says the Prime Minister has a responsibility to try and heal divisions.
It is inevitable that they're being affected by it, so it is up to the leadership, our leadership, to send a message in saying those images, they're not about religion.
Last week, Tony Abbott told a counter-terrorism conference that Islamic State, or Daesh, is coming, if it can, for every person and every government with a simple message, submit or die. That's the sort of language that's got Sheikh Wassam Chakawi worried. He works with Muslim high school students in Western Sydney through the school's chaplaincy program.
You need your leader to speak of calm and not say that the dreaded monster is coming to kill you. And rhetoric like that for political points just increases and adds to that dichotomy of it's them versus us. I mean, the kids do ask and they say sometimes we do feel like we are hated. They hate us. They make us feel like we don't belong because of what they hear And they don't feel represented by their parents. They don't feel represented by their teachers. They don't feel represented by their leaders.
He says Muslim community leaders are working behind the scenes to dissuade young people away from radical Islam. But he says the government's engagement with community leaders has so far been superficial.
To date, not one recommendation that Muslims have put forward has been implemented by the government. The Muslims feel besieged. They feel targeted. They feel as though they're painted with the same brush. So my message is there does need to be genuine engagement. There has to be genuine engagement.
Sheikh Wissam Chakawi speaking to Bill Birtles. Work on a free trade agreement between Australia and China began under the Howard government 10 years ago, and today the two countries will finally seal the deal. China is Australia's top trading partner, with the two-way flow of goods and services exceeding $160 billion last year. As well as cheaper imports, the agreement will see China eliminate import tariffs on about 95% of Australian products coming into the mainland, including dairy, beef, wine, seafood and horticultural products. Andrew Robb is the Trade Minister, and I spoke to him a short time ago. Andrew Robb, this is the third FTA you've signed as Trade Minister. What does this mean for our exports? How significant is it?
By itself, it's hugely significant, but put the three together and you really have got a set of trade agreements with over 50% of our export markets. Given what's going on in the region, the extraordinary explosion of people going into the middle class, this is a very, I think, landmark set of agreements, and it will see literally billions of dollars, thousands, many hundreds of thousands of jobs, and will underpin a lot of our prosperity in the years ahead.
Now, obviously, everybody looks to China as and to Chinese growth continuing. Presumably, the FTA assumes that that growth will continue at a pretty sustainable rate.
Yes, but it's quite conservative on that front. And even things now, you hear a lot of people concerned about growth rates of, 7 or 6.5. But China is now, in the last 6 or 8 years, it's now so much bigger as an economy. It's been growing at 10%. You put 6.5% across the size of the economy now, it's a much bigger number than 10% across the growth or the size of China, even in 2008, 2009.
And what does it mean for the average household, do you think?
Well, we're already seeing, when the Japanese free trade agreement took effect in early January, the big car manufacturers were out there advertising cars up to $7,000 cheaper. We're seeing electronics a lot cheaper already. We're seeing bigger prices for an access for a lot of our products, both agriculture and manufacturing. All of these things are feeding money into pockets, sustaining jobs in Australia.
How many jobs?
Some work that was done by the Centre for International Economics, looking at the benefits of all three free trade agreements, made an assessment that there'll be 9,000 jobs per year. This doesn't take account of either the new investment that will come into the country. And we saw with the US free trade agreement 10 years ago that the investment jumped to well over, the two-way investment flow, well over $1 trillion after 10 years.
But of course, in any deal, there have to be some losers, I assume, and not everybody's happy with this. Although it's a big win for some sectors like dairy, there are some other agricultural sectors like sugar and wheat that I understand were completely left out of this.
Well, that's true. But of course, we do already sell about twice as much sugar to China than we do to the United States, and we sell very significant quantities of wheat. There is no further benefit, but we have agreed as part of the deal that within 3 years we will look at these very difficult areas for China to see whether we can start to see some removal of further protection. This is a document which is not just what we signed today. It's a living document, and it will come under review progressively. And again, that will reflect, what's going on in the region and the growth and the opportunities.
Okay, the FTA will also promote further Australian investment in China and Chinese investment in Australia, which, as you know, is a pretty sensitive issue at the moment because of rising community concern about Chinese acquisition of farms and real estate. Do you agree with Barnaby Joyce, who'd like to see a ban on all foreign governments and foreign-owned state companies from buying Australian farmland?
I think what Barnaby was saying, essentially, was that, you know, there has been and there should be rules which are different for investments from private companies, wherever that is, including China, or from government-owned companies. Now, that has always been the case, and I think always should be. In fact, you know, from the very first dollar of any investment by a government-owned enterprise of activities in Australia, it must go before the Foreign Investment Review Board. And
sure, but isn't that the problem with doing business with China? Because often that line is pretty hard to find, isn't it?
No, well, every SOE or state-owned enterprise who seeks to buy into property or any major investment in Australia, it comes under those provisions. Now, that system has worked very satisfactorily. It has, I think, given a lot of comfort to many Australians about these deals being done in the national interest.
Okay, just quickly on the broader trade agreements. Last time we spoke, you were hopeful that an agreement would be reached on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but the US Congress has knocked the fast-track mechanism out. Will that derail the hopes for the TPP for the moment?
Look, it's getting quite problematic in the United States. We are literally a 1 week of negotiation away from completing this extraordinary deal, and across 12 countries and 40% of the world's GDP. But the US Congress, as it has sometimes before caused a problem, you can see the political heat's rising by the day over there because of the presidential election next year. So I don't think anyone can call it. But if it's not dealt with in the next 2 or 3 weeks, I think it's we've got a real problem with the future of the TPP.
So you don't sound very confident then?
Yeah, I think a lot of people felt very comforted by the fact it got through the Senate, which was seen to be the difficult passage. But now it's before the House. It's facing a number of barriers, and I don't think anyone really knows where it's going to finish up.
Andrew Robb, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Michael.
And that's the Trade Minister, Andrew Robb, there. In Britain, the husbands of three sisters who've disappeared with their 9 children have made an emotional appeal for them to come home. The fear is they've gone with their children, aged between 3 and 15, to join Islamic State in Syria. Philip Williams reports from London.
It's not so unusual for young men and some women to leave the comfort of their British homes to go and fight, and in some cases die, in Syria. But this is very different. When the three sisters from Bradford, Khadija, Sugra and Sora Daywood, failed to return from a pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia, their husbands at home in Britain started to worry. When it became clear their wives and children had flown to Istanbul, a common stop on the way to Syria, concern turned to desperation. Speaking from Bradford, Akhtar Iqbal had this message for his wife and children.
I miss you. I love you. All of you, I love you a lot. I can't live without you. I like to my family. Please, please call me. At least I know where are you. Are you safe?
Sitting beside him, another of the husbands, Mohammed Shoaib.
We've been married 11 years and we were in perfect relationship. She knew it. Please come back. The kids cannot live without me. They miss me so much. The last time that my daughter Mariam said, Daddy, I cried night time. I cried all night for you.
And there with the men, family lawyer Balal Khan.
We make an appeal for the Turkish authorities to cooperate with the British authorities, and we hope that senior officials will take this case on personally and ensure the safe return of the family members.
It's believed the sister's brother is in Syria. The fear that he or others may have lured his three sisters and their children into a war-ravaged country. Joanna Cook is from King's College in London.
It is an active war zone, and the life that they show to individuals is not the life that you will experience while you're there. There is sexual violence. That the scale of sexual violence there is incredible. The things like PTSD that the children within Syria right now are experiencing, it is an active war zone.
It's estimated hundreds of British Muslims have travelled to Syria, but this is a new and deeply worrying case, especially for those left at home wondering why. This is Philip Williams in London reporting for AM.
And to finance, James Murdoch has been confirmed as chief executive of the global media giant 21st Century Fox. The widely expected news comes after last week's move by his father Rupert to streamline the family succession plan. Rupert Murdoch will join his other son Lachlan as co-executive chairman of Fox. In other financial news, Wall Street has closed 0.6% higher, and the Australian dollar is lower this morning at 77.42 US cents. That's AM for today. I'm Michael Brissenden. It's 7:30.